You're listening to the Chances Report on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Dave Edwards, and joining me, of course, is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Mike Lovell. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Dave.
And school is back in session. Classes started back on September 3rd. Always a fun and interesting time. Students looking for classes, parking lots filling up, and a lot of traditions all at the same time.
Yeah, it's a great time to be on campus when a new semester starts, and there's a new energy and excitement because you have several thousands of new students coming with hopes and aspirations, and it's just a great time on campus.
Yeah, so I understand there was had a big welcome for the students, and it even included free food, I understand.
Yeah, and you know, as we've talked before, we have many more traditional students on our campus, and so we want to do more to get them connected to campus even their first days when they step on the Kenwood campus. And so what we did this year is we had a welcome week for the students, and as part of that, we had some new traditions that we started, and one of them was we had a chancellor's welcome on Saturday, August 31st, where we had more than 2,000 students on Mitchell Lawn. We had a short program for them, you know, where we had about four or five people just address them for a few minutes. We had their class picture taken on the lawn. We had them sign banners for the class of 2017. And then we also, one of the unique things is we gave them a coin that had the class of 2017. And as part of the program, we went from Mitchell Hall over to Spates Plaza. And as they processed over to Spates Plaza for a dinner that we had for them, we walked by the fountain next to the library. And so we asked the students to make a goal for themselves over the next 4 years and throw the coin into the fountain as they processed by on the way to dinner. And then what we did is we collected all the coins back up, and then we're going to give them to them at commencement in 2017 when they graduate as they walk across the stage. And it's a small thing, but again, it's just a new tradition that we've started that we're going to do every year going forward.
That's a very, very clever clever idea. That's fun. It'll be interesting to see if you ask some of those students in 2017 if they've achieved their goals.
Yeah, and you know, one of the big things we stressed is the reason why we called them the class 2017 and we gave them the coin is we want them to be thinking about trying to graduate in 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, because again, we all know that students, you know, oftentimes take longer, but it's in their best interest to try to get out as soon as they can.
Yeah, the criticism years ago was that universities made it very difficult for students. I mean, I realize there are some programs that aren't neatly tied up in 4 years, but the concern was that because of cutbacks, because of difficulties in scheduling classes, that it was really next to impossible to achieve a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. Is it?
No, it's not impossible. The point you're making is very good in the fact that it is a challenge for the campuses to offer enough sections to get everyone through the things that they would need to graduate. And we did an analysis that I believe it takes, for most programs, 120, 124 credits to graduate, but many students end up taking 136 credits to graduate. I think that was the average of our graduates because they're taking classes that they're interested in, but sometimes they're not always what they need, the prerequisites to graduate. And that could be because they're not getting good advising or not concerning their advisor, maybe they can't get into certain sections and have to take other courses sometimes.
Yeah. You know, on the other hand, I think back to when I went to school, it was good to take some classes that weren't necessarily going to apply to my major, but these were just things that I was interested in. I would have never taken a psychology class other than the fact that I was interested. I thought, well, let's try that.
Yeah, no, and that's a good point. And one of the things that, you know, I think is very important is for students to be well-rounded. So if you're in a program, professional program, whether it be engineering or nursing or something in health sciences, sometimes it's good to take classes maybe in the humanities or the arts, you know, mm-hmm. just to get a new full perspective on things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great segue to the fact that every year in the fall you address the Faculty Senate and you talk about the state of the university and you kind of do the big picture thinking. What were the major topics at this year's event?
Well, I kind of led off by talking about the challenges facing campus. It was, you know, we have three big challenges. One is that at the most recent Regents meeting, some state legislators brought up, it was called a common ground meeting, where we were trying to come to a common ground between the system and the Regents with the legislature, with all the problems we had last year over primarily the surplus and, you know, them being upset with the universities. And one of the things that came up there was the idea that we need to look into shared governance, you know, which is really, you know, the fabric of what the system has been based on since it was initiated, discussing the fact that maybe faculty slow down processes and things on the campuses because of the shared governance process. And maybe we should look into taking away the shared governance or changing it so that the campus can run a little more efficiently. And one of the things I talked about was the fact that since I've been chancellor, I don't think shared governance has ever slowed anything down that I've ever thought it was a big initiative for campus. I would say, on the contrary, oftentimes things outside of the campus have been what slowed us down, you know, whether it be policies or different things we've had to go through. So I want to get you
to describe this a little bit, because for those of our listeners who are not affiliated with the university, the term shared governance may be meaningless.
Okay.
So describe what that is or how the university, in fact, runs and what's the issue here.
Yeah. So the university, myself being chancellor, I'm not like a CEO where I make decisions and then it actually filters down through the campus. There's actually a set of checks and balances. So initiatives the campus want to do, there's actually the faculty have a say in how it's done or if it gets done at all. And so there's the faculty senate and the university committee all have a relationship with the administration, and even the students have a say in making decisions on the campus. And it's not to say that we can all, you know, stop each other from doing what we want to do, but certainly we can block each other's efforts or slow each other down if for some reason we all get crosswise with each other. So for a university to work well in a shared governance process, you know, you really need alignment of all the constituents. Why I like shared governance is the fact that if we're doing something or making major decisions for the future of campus, having a large group of people having input on the decisions that you're making gives you all the different perspectives, you know, when looking at something, so that you don't make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I've found that, you know, for our process, certainly having the input of the faculty and the staff on the campus on initiatives we want to do certainly, you know, ensures that, you know, the campus is not going to make any mistakes that are really going to hurt our future.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't it be easier for you or other chancellors to just be able to be, you know, to get input, but then act like a CEO and say, no, this is what we're going to do. Thanks for your input.
Well, and that's kind of the way it works now, but the shared governance process makes it more formal.
Okay.
You know, and so I've often said, even if they did take away shared governance, you know, I would still want the input from, you know, all the faculty and staff on campus on their major initiatives, just because they really do bring a unique perspective and think of things in ways that I might necessarily not think of them.
Mm-hmm. Faculty members I know are of course concerned about this, and they're also worried about where this comes from and whether or not this is a system initiative that is somehow being pushed through by system and by chancellors like you.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my plenary, the first thing I said was that, you know, that I assured everyone that I wanted to be a chancellor and not a CEO of a campus. You know, I don't think that you know, understanding, you know, faculty and the way universities operate, you know, a CEO has, you know, full authority, you know, over the organizations that they run. When you have tenured faculty, you know, it's a much different dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, because tenured faculty, you know, there's, you know, they're going to be on the campus for, you know, for 20 years with a certain set of security, and so working with them and making sure that, you know, that we are in harmony with the faculty and the staff is very important, and you cannot run a campus as a CEO.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the challenges you face and your colleagues face, whether you're chancellor, CEO, or something in between, is dealing with the biennial budget and its impact. You've had plenty of time to digest what the governor and the legislature approved back in July. You've had a summer to think about it. What are you thinking about it, and what did you tell the faculty?
Yeah. Well, certainly the new budget includes this year a 6.9 base budget reduction, which will then become $8.2 million next year on ongoing. So that's a major, you know, obviously a major amount of money that we need to find, you know, how we're going to cut on the campus. And so we talked before that first $6.9 million, we really didn't have time to plan for that. You mm-hmm. know, that kind of came out in June. And so when many people had left the campus, and so the very first year of the biennium, we're going to try to use reserves to cover that. And one of the really good things that happened is that our faculty and staff were very they conserved a lot of energy last year. And so we had a $4 million in energy savings that we were able to put to the first year of the cut. So the $6.9 million for that will be coming from, you know, cost savings on energy, and the rest will be coming from balances we have. And the reason why we're doing that is we want to keep all sections and courses open this year, both in the fall and spring semesters. We don't want the current cut to impact the operation, particularly for the students getting into classes like we talked about earlier, making sure students can graduate in a timely manner. It's going to be more difficult. It's going to be very difficult, though, when you talk about the ongoing $8.2 million base budget reduction. We won't have one-time money to put towards that each year, obviously. And so we're actually going through a process where we're going to determine how we're going to come up with that money. And I've charged Provost Britz and Vice Chancellor Robin Van Harpen to work with governance groups on the campus to determine how we're going to implement those. And we haven't made any final decisions, but they have set a set of four guiding principles that really they're going to try to minimize the impact on our core activities. They're going to look for more efficiencies to save money on campus, you know, invest strategically in areas that will help us increase our revenue, and we're going to try to equitably cut across all units. And through this process, you know, obviously we've already 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the Goldwaters had a report that said we were one of the leanest campuses in the country, so any cuts are going to be really hard.
Mm-hmm. So people are going to notice these cuts, then.
Oh, there's no doubt. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very difficult.
And so your goal, as you just stated, of keeping all the sections open and allowing students to graduate in 4 years is going to become more difficult to accomplish, I think.
Yeah, and one of the ways that, you know, again, we're not going to micromanage how individual units implement the cuts, but one of the ways they've done in the past is they've had, when faculty members have retired or left, they've just left those positions unfilled, and that's the way they've done the cuts. You can imagine, I think I saw a note that, you know, our faculty over the last few years, the number of faculty on our campus have gone down. You know, mm-hmm. I think we're about 50 less than we were a few years ago. And it's just because the way that we've implemented the cuts over the years has just been not filling those vacant positions.
What about opportunities for new revenue?
Well, I think that's the important thing, particularly for me as chancellor, that, you know, I need to find new revenue streams on the campus. One of the big ones right now is that we have an incentive grant program for the UW system, $22.5 million that we're writing proposals for to really help jumpstart the economy in Wisconsin. And so, you know, we have a group of about we have five proposals going in for this, and we have a large number of faculty and staff working on campus. And I couldn't be prouder of the proposals that are coming forward. I think that all these proposals are worthy of funding, and I think that we'll be very well positioned for that $22.5 million. And one of the things for me that I'm excited about is we're getting a lot of support from some of our partners in the community and in corporations, you know, to collaborate and write support letters for us because they see how UWM can help drive the economy in southeastern Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. What about dollars coming from the University of Wisconsin system itself?
Well, one of the things we're having a conversation right now between the chancellors and the system are the way that GPR and tuition is allocated back to the campuses. The current model which is used was developed in the 1970s, and this was before UWM had our huge enrollment and our research growth. And so when you think about the way that the funds are being distributed on a per-student basis, it really doesn't make much sense. And, you know, I've argued all along that the way the GPR and tuition is sent to the campuses, the model that's used, should align with the goals of the system in the state that would incentivize the campuses to achieve those goals. Mm-hmm. Right now, the way it's implemented, because it was implemented back in the 70s, it's based on what we were and not what we want to be. And so it doesn't incentivize campuses necessarily to grow the number of students on your campus, because you don't get additional, you know, funding per student, you know, based on that way. And so, but we hear all the time that the system in the state wants us to graduate more mm-hmm. in Wisconsin residents, because we know how important that is to the future of the state. And so, you know, currently now on a per student basis, as an example, campuses like Madison Superior get more than twice as much per FTE student than Milwaukee. And so, you know, that really doesn't make sense to anybody. It's just that this is a model that's been around for, you know, 40 some years. It's time to relook at it and make sure that, you know, this that the allocation is done in a way that, as I said before, really incentivizes the campuses to do what the state needs us to do.
Michael Lovell, Chancellor of UWM, is our guest in conversation. I want to come back to that one point, though. You know, when you said Madison Superior lead the list on that, I guess Madison doesn't surprise us because it's sort of intuitive that a lot of money goes to Madison as a flagship campus. But Superior?
Yes. Yeah, and Superior and Parks are the next two after Madison. And again, those are the two smallest campuses. And so, you know, and I'm not sure, again, none of us really understand the model the way it's been implemented, you know, in recent years. Again, I just want to point this 4 years old, and I think it just has to do with the fact that their enrollments have remained small. Mm-hmm. And so as their support has gone, you know, their support's kind of stayed constant or grown up with inflation slowly. Their student body has, you know, stayed as it probably was back in the 70s. So incrementally, that per student's gone up. First of all, like Milwaukee, who has had significant growth in our enrollment over the last, you know, 20 years, especially, you know, that we now get less and less per student as we grow.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've stressed on this program before that you and the other chancellors are kind of in this together, and that you described how the former chancellor at the Madison campus, the two of you had worked together on a number of projects, how you want to work with the Duke. But as you talk about revisiting this model, there's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And is that going to pit one campus against another?
Well, I think, and I actually think there's a way we can do this that necessarily we wouldn't have winners and losers. One of the things that came up at the last Regents meeting, Chancellor Blank from Madison discussed how the out-of-state tuition in Madison is $14,000 less than out-of-state tuition in Michigan. And the market would allow them to charge a lot more for out-of-state tuition without hurting their out-of-state enrollments. If you think about that, if 25% of the Madison's campus, you know, which is 11,000-12,000 students, you had $14,000 more, you're able to charge $14 more, think about how much more revenue that would bring into the system that would allow Madison maybe to not be impacted by the new model.
Yeah, but you and I both know that raising tuition is like suddenly become the third rail, and that's what really kind of started off this discussion last spring. And so what's the likelihood of that happening?
Well, I think the most concern of people in the state is in-state tuition. So they wouldn't be raising in-state tuition at all. It would just be for their out-of-state students as an example of way we can do this so that we would have more revenue so that it wouldn't necessarily be – it would certainly soften the blow of any impact of winners and losers.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about the impact on just general fundraising. Again, another topic we've talked about on the show quite a bit. But a lot of times we talk about fundraising in terms of special programs or scholarships or things like that. Is fundraising to sort of for general operations going to have to ramp up?
You know, it's very difficult to fundraise for general operations, you know, and so I think that I think scholarships, faculty excellence, you know, those are the big things, you know, endowed chairs. I even see reluctance of funders to fund buildings a lot of times because they believe that that's something the state should be investing into the campuses or the new buildings. They would rather fund specific programs. And so I think getting fundraising for general operations is not something that is going to be really feasible from the donors. Other ways to get money for your general operations, though, is when you increase research, there's an overhead, about 50% that the federal government pays for money brought in to research the campuses. Now, that is a source for general operations, you know, maintaining or upgrading facilities, for example, is something we could do with those funds.
But overall, fundraising has to be a piece of this.
Oh, no, there's no doubt. Yeah, and it's very important for the campus.
So you're talking about student tuition dollars, be they from in-state or out-state students. But yet we've been seeing a trend of decreasing enrollment. Mm-hmm. And is that part of this picture?
Well, sure. And it's very important when you consider – we've talked before about how the demographics of the state – there's going to be less high school graduates until 2018. And we're really seeing that happening on our campus. This is the third straight year our freshman class was smaller and our total enrollment is down. And we think about – we're going to have about 1,000 fewer students on our campus compared to last year. That has a real impact on the finances of campus. And we're looking about a decrease of about $10.8 million in less tuition revenue because of the decreased enrollment. And, you know, there's really two main reasons. I mentioned one already, the demographics, but also getting back to Madison, you know, they have a cap of 25%, you know, out-of-state students, you know, that they're allowed to bring in. Well, last year they went over the cap, and I believe they were about a percentage or so above that, I think maybe about 26.2 if I recall correctly. And how are they going to – how did they counteract that this year? Well, they had more in-state students, you know, to get that number down below 25%. And unfortunately, we're the campus that's most impacted when Madison brings in more Wisconsin residents because we're oftentimes the second choice. And one of the things we noticed this year was even more so than previous years, we had more of our students transfer to Madison than we have previously. Hmm. You know, I think that they had a concerted effort to try to bring in more transfer students, you know, from the state of Wisconsin. And I'm certainly not going to blame Madison. They did what they had to do, and we're all aware of it. But, you know, there certainly are implications to us and some of the other campuses when that happens.
So a couple of months ago on our show, you were talking about some of the things that UWM was doing to reverse this trend and some really creative ideas. And where are you with that, and are you seeing results at all?
Well, we're being very proactive. You know, we saw the enrollment, particularly last year, we saw where the trends were going. And I said last year, my plenary a year ago, that if we didn't reverse the enrollment trends, we'd be at, you know, 25,500 students, you know, in 3 or 4 years. That was where the trajectory was going, knowing the demographics and things. And so we've really been very active in trying to help boost our enrollments. The first is we hired 6 new recruiters this summer, and we're going to deploy them both in the state and the surrounding states. And so we really are going to do a concerted effort to try to better recruit students and make students, particularly in the states surrounding Wisconsin, aware of UWM and all the great things it has to offer. We also hired a firm, TargetX, to be a secret shopper on our campus. And what they did is they come for the campus visit, and then they came and gave us feedback through a report. And there were several areas of the campus visit that showed that we need to improve. And as it turns out, the biggest correlation between a student coming to a university is their campus visit. Hmm. So if they have a positive campus visit, they're likely to matriculate there. And so we have the report now. We're systematically going through the report and addressing every one of the areas of improvement to really try to enhance the experience that students and their families have when they visit us. You know, and that's really a great recruiting tool. We've also really changed our marketing for the campus. We're now not just marketing UWM, but marketing the city of Milwaukee as a reason why people should come to UWM. The city has a lot to offer, and we believe that, you know, a concerted effort between the city of Milwaukee and UWM, and we talk about all the activities, whether it be in the arts or the sports or recreational, it's really a great place. And so mm-hmm. we've really piggybacked off of some of the things that you know, the city, you know, is marketing itself as well, so we can enroll more students. And finally, I think we may have talked about this before, we started something called the Milwaukee Advantage, where we are high-performing students from out of state. You know, when they apply to UWM, we automatically give them a $1,000 scholarship just for applying. And this scholarship actually makes us very cost-competitive with in-state tuition in other states, particularly Illinois, mm-hmm. you know, and so we think that that'll help. So we've really we're an all-time high. You know, this has really paid off. You know, we're an all-time high in out-of-state students. We're up to about 11.6% of out-of-state students. Where over the past decade, we've gone from 6. We've almost doubled our number of out-of-state students. You know, that's a great trajectory. But also another big thing is looking at international students. Again, we were up 15%. Again, we've really done a concerted effort to try to recruit more international students. We're using our faculty who come from all over the world to help us develop strategies for recruiting the students. And just as an example, you know, we had very few students from Brazil on our campus, and this year we brought in 105 new students. And it's just, you know, a lot of that was through some recruiting efforts that are, we have 9 or 10 faculty from Brazil on our campus that mm-hmm. went back and really helped get some of the students here.
Yeah. I've attended to a number of these plenaries over the years, and many of them have been largely pep rallies to try to get people to feel excited about coming back and being a part of this whole thing. And it sounds like the message that you were sharing with the faculty and the campus community was, you know, you're trying to show a little optimism, but there was a lot of cold water being thrown on the room. Is that
yeah.
is that fair?
Oh no, the challenges we're facing are real, and you know, I would, if I wasn't presenting that to the campus, you know, I wouldn't really be a good leader. And you know, what I did say though, I mean, there is optimism that we all can be part of the solution, and you know, it was really great because for the first plenary since I've been chancellor, there was about 15 minutes of questions afterwards. Sometimes there was I do my plenary and there's no questions. But the questions were it was very clear that people were engaged. And, you know, the one that really struck me was, and in fact, I remember standing up, they said, well, what can we do to help? And that's really the, well, you know, we're all in together. And, you know, we're actually going to be developing a kind of a pamphlet and brochure that talks about things that faculty do can do to help with the enrollments. And that's, you know, in a way from, you know, helping us recruit students to, you know, be involved in different programs. We're actually going to put faculty on a bus and they're going to tour the state of Wisconsin. We're going to get about 40 faculty and they're going to go out and meet with students. And, you know, it just, you know, I think it's, you know, I often talk about our faculty, and I've said this many times publicly in the past, is that, you know, I see what our faculty do with very little resources, and they do just amazing things, and I describe them as most innovative and entrepreneurial faculty and staff that I've ever been associated with in my career. And so, you know, I know that we can get through this, you know, but it's just going to take everyone's, you know, concerted effort.
Yeah. We've just got a few minutes left, but I wanted to touch on one thing. We talked in the past about the Global Water Center at UWM, actually off the main campus, but it's been getting a lot of interesting coverage, including from Al Jazeera America.
Yeah. Well, we had a really fantastic ribbon cutting on September 12th, and this was just a fabulous. And the building itself, you know, includes. You know, we're the biggest tenants on the seventh floor where we have our faculty that are doing really translational research around water. But all the anchors, the Badger Meter, A.O. Smith, Veolia, you know, are located, you know, in the building as well, as long as a number of startup companies and other organizations. And so this building is really transformational for Milwaukee because it really establishes another way we're establishing ourselves as a national water hub. And so we actually had Al Jazeera came and, you know, covered the event and interviewed many of us. And it was really very exciting, you know, to see that the way that they're scribing, you know, this is us being a water destination.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are very excited about what that's going to do for the neighborhood, too, not just for the water industry, not just for UWM, but just for a section of the community that's been largely ignored. And I bet a lot of people don't even know where that is.
Yeah, so and it's over in the Fifth Ward, and they've renamed the street Freshwater Way, which was pretty appropriate. And we're already seeing, when you go over there, it's already starting to transform, you know, the restaurants and other shops that are moving in. And just across the street, the city is actually talking about transforming that area to recruit more water companies and put in a very nice, you know, park system. It's right across the river from the Harley Museum. I think it's going to be, I think the Fifth Ward 5-6 years from now is going to be much like the Third Ward. Yeah, I think it's just going to be a continuum the way it's developing. And we're excited to be part of that. It's part of what it is to be a university in an urban setting and being really an anchor for the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. I know there was so much more we could be talking about, but we'll invite you back next month. We'll do it again.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave.
Great. Mike Lovell is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. This has been the Chancellor's Report on WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Dave Edwards. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Dave.